When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Here, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Brexit Means, The Guardian's weekly dispatch from Brexit land, where, with the next EU summit barely 30 working days away, things are beginning to heat up ever so slightly, as the moment fast approaches when Theresa May will finally have to make some of the tough choices she's been so successfully putting off for the past 18 months or so. Though, if past form is anything to go by, don't hold your breath. Anyway, the debate this week has revolved mainly around four little words: in and out, and the or a. I'm talking, of course, about the customs union, or if you prefer, a customs union, or indeed a customs arrangement, or even a customs partnership. Sometimes even a streamlined customs partnership. Now, this may all sound very arcane, but it really does go to the heart of the Brexit question, namely, exactly what kind of relationship does the UK want with the EU after it leaves? As the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, has just gently reminded everyone, it really is make-your-mind-up time, and the Brexit War Cabinet is meeting this week to supposedly do just that. Barnier's opposite number, David Davis, of course, insists that Britain made its mind up ages ago and has been perfectly clear about what it wants. The problem, unfortunately, is that that doesn't seem to be on offer. So, what's all this customs stuff about? With me to try and shine some light into the impenetrable Brexit fog are, on the line from Brussels, The Guardian's correspondent there, Jennifer Rankin, and here in the studio, Brexit policy editor Dan Roberts. Welcome to you both, as ever. Dan, can I turn to you first? Let's put you right on the spot. It has been a very confusing few days, even more confusing than normal, I could perhaps say. First, Liam Fox said Britain has to be out. Then Theresa May, she said that she has an open mind on the question. Then Anna Soubry and Ken Clark launched a bid to keep the UK in at all costs. Then Amber Rudd said it might be an alternative. And finally, just a couple of days ago, Number 10 finally said that Britain will definitely not be a member of either the or a customs union. So first, can you just explain in layman's terms what is a customs union? Specifically, I guess to start with, the EU's customs union, and why people like Philip Hammond and Britain's bigger businesses, at least, are very keen to stay in it and the Brexiteers want out.
Yes, it's been a voyage of discovery for everybody in this week, but we have to look on the bright side. And the bright side is we finally got politicians to articulate the difference between the definite and the indefinite article. and I think it bears just simple explanation there. The customs union of the European Union is something that's only available to European Union members. It is the arrangement by which we make sure that you don't have to have any checks at the border. And it comes with a simple cost, which is that you have to have a shared external tariff, which means that basically anybody importing into the European Union has a single tariff that applies everywhere, and anybody exporting out, likewise the same. What that means is, in practice, not only do British goods travelling to France not have to be checked, but crucially, and this is the really important thing, Japanese imports coming into the UK don't then have to be checked again if they're being transshipped.
If they come in first to like Rotterdam or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And this matters enormously for this, sorry to introduce another technical term, but these so-called rules of origin are really important for manufacturers, because what happens is, if a car is being imported from one European country to another, it doesn't have to be checked to see what proportion of components have come from Japan or the UK, because it is assumed that because we're in within this single European customs union, it's already been done once. And so that matters, because the Brits want to have a free trade agreement with Europe, that there aren't any tariffs between Britain and France. So you might say to yourself, well, why does it matter whether we have customs checks, because there's no customs tariffs to apply? Well, why it matters is because in a very integrated world economy, bits of products come from all over the world, and we need to know
where they come from. And whether they comply with the right standards, I guess.
Standards is a whole other thing. But even just within tariffs, there are rules governing what proportion of a car can come from within one country if it is going to benefit from a free trade agreement. So a customs union is hugely important in keeping things smooth and making sure that goods can travel around without extensive delays at the border.
Okay, all right. So it's about tariffs, and it's also about kind of infrastructure and delays at the border and that kind of thing, and pile-ups of trucks at Dover or Calais.
Yes, it matters enormously in the case of the Irish border, because you don't want to have any delays to make people feel that there is a national border. The whole of the Irish peace process has been a fudge based on the idea that people can pretend that they're in two different countries at the same time. And that only works if you don't have a visible border. But it also matters at Dover, for example, if you have a highly integrated supply chain for the automotive industry. Honda are bringing in huge amounts of parts from all over Europe, and then they're exporting cars back across that border. If there are extensive delays at Honda, it completely screws up their just-in-time supply chains. It also makes it hard for them to import cars back across the border into Europe without proving that there's a certain proportion that have come from the UK. So it matters across all borders that the UK will have in future with the EU.
Okay. So that's the customs union. Jennifer, so what do we mean when we talk about a customs union? Does the EU have other customs unions apart from the one that Dan's just been talking about?
Yes, well, you could really sum this up as the "and what about Turkey?" Because this is the country that's always mentioned when we talk about a customs union, because of course Turkey is not an EU member state, but it does have a customs union with the EU, as do the tiny micro states of Andorra and San Marino. But I think that the case of Turkey being obviously a much larger country is more interesting. So Turkey does sign up to the EU's common tariff. It does sign up to most of the common rules on how goods travel over the border, but it doesn't sign up to key aspects of the EU trade policy. For example, it doesn't sign up to the EU anti-dumping laws, the laws where the EU has can put punitive tariffs when it suspects goods are being produced at below market prices. We've seen a lot of this on, for example, steel from China. The EU has retaliated with high tariffs, and Turkey doesn't have to do this because it isn't part of that common policy.
Right.
So it does also mean, importantly for our Brexit debate, that Turkey is free to strike free trade agreements with other countries.
Right, because that is a key argument for the pro-Brexit camp, isn't it? That the flip side of the customs union that we've just been talking about, with all the benefits that it has, the flip side of it is that you are not allowed, if you're a member of that union, to go and negotiate your own deals outside it.
Exactly so. So the attraction on the surface of the Turkey model is that Turkey is free to strike free trade agreements with other countries. However, the catch is that other countries are not always interested in striking free trade agreements with Turkey because they already gain access to the Turkish market through any EU free trade agreements. And that puts Turkey in a very weak position. For example, Turkey was very unhappy that it couldn't take part in the TTIP negotiations with the United States, but it would have to be subject to that trade deal if it had gone ahead. It subsequently didn't. We had Donald Trump arriving and those negotiations were thrown out of the window. But nonetheless, Turkey's often been frustrated because it would like to create its own free trade agreements, but the partner countries of the European Union have had no incentive to do this because Turkey can fall under the umbrella of the EU's arrangements. So it's really not an attractive model for Brexiteers who want Britain to take that sort of supposedly go out in the world and sign trade agreements with all sorts of countries.
OK, well, that's cleared up the sort of the and a question, I think, more or less. Back to you, Dan, because, I mean, you know, despite the pleas of what we might call the Brexit realists, the Hammond camp, I suppose, the government appears now pretty much to have definitively ruled out membership of either the or a customs union. And instead, it's talking about a customs arrangement or a very streamlined customs partnership. Now, have I got that wrong?
Yeah, it's slightly wrong. You're almost there. It's a highly streamlined arrangement.
Oh, okay.
Or a new customs partnership.
Yeah. That's right. A highly streamlined arrangement or a new customs partnership. Now, what are they when they're at home?
Well, I think one way of look, these were two options that were outlined in the summer when the government produced its policy paper on customs. And they were widely dismissed at the time as slightly pie in the sky, but they do fit into the category of cake and eat it. They are designed to make it look like we can continue to have all the friction-free benefits of being inside A or the customs union, but without actually being.
Yeah.
And they sound very similar, and that's because basically there are a Whitehall way of describing this continuum that there exists that basically just trying to kind of mitigate the damage of new customs barriers. Just to sum up between the two of them, highly streamlined arrangement model is a bit like what Switzerland has. And the idea is basically to use technology, number plate recognition cameras and the like, and spot checks, and putting the onus on companies, the big companies, to have trusted trader schemes where they declare their their exports in advance or monthly. And there are all ways of trying to reduce the amount of checks that need to be done. It needs to be remembered, though, that as the Select Committee heard this morning, Switzerland still conducts checks on about 2% of the lorries that cross the border. And that in the context of Ireland, for example, would be 300 checks a day. So this is still, that's a physical check. That's on top of all the number plate recognition. Now, the Brits would like to say, well, if we up the number of cameras and have even more clever computer schemes, and we can get that down to, you know, a tiny percent of spot checks, and you wouldn't even know it's there. That's the bit where people are quite sceptical that technology can suddenly solve all these things. Switzerland does some of this, and the border delays, I'm told, or I've experienced, are not massive, but they are still there. Whitehall has even more heroically described as a customs partnership, and this would be an attempt to basically get around the rules of origin problem that I talked about earlier on. And the idea being that an American car arrives at Southampton destined for sale in France, we would, at the border, the British border, would collect any tariffs that were due on that on behalf of the French and then pass them on. And the same would come if a Japanese car was to arrive at the port of Genoa bound for a British market.
Okay.
They would collect our any duties that were
due to Britain.
Then.
Yeah.
And the idea, the bit where it gets really heroic, is that with both the Southampton customs official and the Genoese customs official would have to monitor somehow the ongoing passage of that car through the supply chain to make sure it did eventually get to where it was meant to be. Now, again, the Brits like to say, well, if you wave enough technology at this, if you have really clever, sophisticated software systems that can, and trusted trader schemes and all the rest of it, you can make this work. Mm. I think, just listening to me, you can see how complicated and ambitious
absolutely.
This would be. But the idea is, if you get it working completely smoothly, you don't have to have a common external tariff in order to continue to have the sort of benefits that a customs union provides. In theory.
In theory. Jennifer, how does the EU view these two proposals, sort of these in theory proposals? What, when we heard this last year when the proposals for the Irish border were kind of dismissed as magical thinking in Brussels, is this pretty much what they were talking about?
Yes, it is. And the short answer is the EU views both of these proposals with a huge amount of scepticism about this British idea of British officials collecting customs duties for the EU. And this comes in the context of a case, an investigation by the EU's anti-fraud office, which is currently looking at UK customs officials who they say have failed to collect customs duties owed by Chinese importers. And there's a suggestion here of artificially cheap goods, of even of criminal gangs pouring cheap clothes and shoes onto the European market. And this is a result of the failure of UK customs officials. At least that's the conclusion that EU investigators have drawn so far. It's refuted by the British government, I should say. But nonetheless, it feeds into this general climate of scepticism about the British proposal here on this special customs arrangement.
Okay, so neither of those are looking particularly promising. Dan, did you want to?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the other thing to remember is that customs has been used as a bit of a shorthand in the British political debate in the last couple of weeks for all checks at the border. But actually, customs is only one tiny bit of the bigger physical barriers that exist at borders, because you've got to remember that it's not just tariffs that might need to be dealt with, but there's also varying VAT rates across countries that also need to be monitored and vehicles stopped and checked to make sure there's not smuggling and so forth. The regulatory issues, we've talked in previous podcasts about regulatory harmonisation, but a big one is on food and agriculture, milk tankers being conceivably stopped at the border, the Irish border, to make sure that they haven't been fed GM crops or sorts of things. Phytosanitary standards is another huge area, veterinary checks for live animals, security, and then the really big one is immigration. I mean, much of Europe benefits from Schengen, and the Irish border benefits from an equivalent of Schengen, the common travel area. But the British border with the rest of the EU in future will have big immigration checks, because we will be checking passports and visas and so forth. So we've got to remember, when we talk about customs, we're not that's not just a shorthand for the only physical checks. There are a whole host of things that a border consists
of. And potential for massive holdups and mayhem. Okay, well, I hope that's pretty much cleared it up. We did have a couple of emails from listeners during the week saying, you know, could you please try and explain this sort of customs business? I hope we've done so. There's one other final issue that I'd like to quickly look at, because the people who argue that Britain should be outside any kind of customs union are basically the proponents of this global Britain that you, Jennifer, were talking about a bit earlier, this sort of buccaneering vision of a UK boldly cutting trade deals with countries all around the world and building itself a glorious economic future. The trouble is, and we saw this last week, that a lot of economists, including it now seems the experts at the Treasury, are of the opinion that those trade deals outside the EU will nowhere near offset the hit that UK trade is set to take from leaving the single market and the EU's customs union. Now, two of the most fervent believers in global Britain are Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's an increasingly prominent pro-Brexit Tory backbencher, and similarly hardline Brexit minister Steve Baker. And they had a very interesting exchange last week, which I'd just like to discuss briefly. To cut a long story short, Rees-Mogg asked Baker, who had earlier written off all official forecasts as always wrong, whether the Treasury had, and I quote, deliberately developed a model to show that all options other than staying in the customs union were bad. Baker then said basically, yes, it had. He was then forced to apologise because, of course, it hadn't. May refused to sack Baker, which is, some might say, is an indication of how strong she is within the government. But Rees-Mogg later doubled down. He went on and went as far as to say, in fact, that civil servants were actively fiddling the figures. Now, Dan, we're in a fairly dangerous territory here, aren't we? I think when ministers and MPs start openly attacking civil servants, what does this say about about where we are and the divisions within the Conservative Party, the tensions?
Well, we're in a fact-free zone, and I think the trouble is that facts are being weaponized, and the Brexiteers don't like it up them. They don't like the fact that all the experts, particularly trade economists, are of one view on the potential upside of these trade deals overseas versus the loss in Europe. And that's very unpalatable for people who've taken the country to the brink over this very issue. So they only have one recourse, which is to question the motives of those making these arguments. And I think when that gets to the point where ministers are questioning the motives of their own officials, we've reached quite a dark stage.
Jennifer, how was that viewed in Brussels?
I think it's certainly greeted with dismay in Brussels, which is, of course, a town of civil servants.
Yes.
And also one where there is genuine respect across the table for their British counterparts. I think no matter what the view of the British government, of the decision-making level, there is a respect for the officials. These people have known each other for many years, but often they've been part of the same negotiations inside the EU and now find themselves in the strange position of being on the opposite side of the table. But I think it will also feed into the picture of a prime minister under pressure from backbenchers who are beyond her control. And there's long been a sort of a very withering and dismissive tone in Brussels towards some of those Tory Eurosceptics. Jacob Rees-Mogg is a lot less known here, but people are very familiar with Boris Johnson, of course, and his more interesting claims about the European Union and how it works. And I think that just adds to this view of a fact-free government at times, which isn't really where the Prime Minister isn't in control of the agenda.
Yeah, so none of it particularly helpful. Okay, we're getting towards the end. Just before we go, I'd like to very quickly run down on where precisely we are on the timetable. Dan, at the London end, am I right in saying this is basically crunch week for decision making, or can it be pushed off any longer?
They are going to kick this can down the road some more. There will be two Cabinet Select Committee, subcommittee meetings this week on Wednesday and Thursday, where the government will try and draw up its ambitions for the next phase. But I think as the debate over the customs union has shown, the way they've got round the political tensions is largely more cake and eat it.
Okay.
To mix the food metaphors there, because I think they will stand firmly behind the policy objectives set out over the summer for these customs partnerships or highly streamlined arrangements. That won't really take us any further forward on the big question, the big fork in the road about whether you want more access or more sovereignty. But it will allow them to punt the issue down the road for another few months hopefully pass the point of no return next March. And these will all be issues that will only really come out in the transition, when we actually get down to the nitty gritty of working out it
that.
Out.
And Jennifer, what is the deadline for that, particularly for that transition deal? The talks resume, don't they, in Brussels at the end of the week. What are the EU expecting from those, and what needs to be agreed over the coming month or so?
In fact, talks have already resumed today on technical issues. So we do have negotiators talking about transition, but also some of those issues which have now seem almost forgotten about, but the phase one of the agreement on how that agreement shall be governed, on dispute resolution and a lot of technical issues have been ignored and not really seen in the limelight. But also, more importantly, they will be talking about Ireland this week. And that really goes full circle back to the beginning of the conversation about the customs union, because this is really the circle that hasn't been squared yet. And the two sides managed to paper over it in December with some language that everyone can live with. But over the next few weeks, the EU wants to turn that deal agreed in December into a legal document that will be signed at the end of the process. And this is really going to expose the fault line, that how can the UK leave the customs union and maintain a border-free crossing on the island of Ireland? And this is the conundrum that we're going to come back to very, very soon. And it could become a very difficult and moment of truth in these negotiations.
Right. OK, so some fireworks ahead. Well, that really is it for this week. Thank you very much, Dan and Jennifer, for joining me again today. Next week, we're discussing France and Brexit. So if you have any questions about that, do please email us at brexitpodcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. Please subscribe, review on all your favourite podcatchers. Join the discussion on Twitter. You just need to search for Guardian Podcasts. Till next week, then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Rowan Slaney. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.